this on. And return.
Yes.
Okay. Very good. Seems like we are back in business now. And we welcome everybody who's here with us. I guess about 15 of us at the moment. And later in the day, hopefully you'll have a chance to say something if you wish. Let's see. Can't even see my own eyes. I have the glasses on. Just looks like. Actually, Julia took a picture of me looking at a screen with these glasses, and in each lens of the glasses was a big horoscope. So I thought I thought that was really appropriate somehow. Okay, now we begin our analysis of stanza number 7, but maybe I ought to put these on. I'm almost forgetting something. If you see me without my headphones on, just let me know, because otherwise it's a little bit remote. Okay. Now, this imagery is perhaps not too difficult to understand, but there are aspects of it which we might question. Why is it so? Riseth the cave of beauty rare, of color iridescent. Okay. So it, what aspect of man do we think this relates to? Is, you know, the last one, stanza 6, was very much about the personality, wasn't it? And the limitations. It's the whole structure on the higher mental plane, isn't it? Whether we want to call it the egoic lotus or the radiation of the egoic lotus, which we call the causal body. You know, you kind of wonder how big an egoic lotus really is. Could be a tiny, tiny structure. Just think of how much it is possible to store in a permanent atom, which are even smaller than the atoms that we are familiar with in the physical sense. The egoic lotus might be extraordinarily small, but its radiation would extend beyond the auras of the other vehicles. So, you know, that's something that DK really hasn't dealt with. We sometimes think of this big lotus, you know, sort of filling out the causal body, but it could be, the interesting thing about it is that the members of the atomic triangle, mental unit, astral and physical permanent atoms, are in the lower part of the lotus. You know, that's what DK tells us, that they are in the lower part of the lotus. They're included. So if you have an atom of tiny proportions, getting tinier and tinier as we ascend the planes, and then we have a lotus that's how big? See, it could be a microscopic structure. Of course, size doesn't really, you know, it doesn't make a difference on that level. But the radiation is obviously intense. We can speak in terms of space and structure and location when we're still on the cosmic, the dense levels of the cosmic physical plane, i.e. the lower 21 subplanes. We can still speak of location relative. As a matter of fact, we can even speak of shape and size in terms of the cosmic ethers, because we're told very interestingly that the Buddhic permanent atom is shaped how? What is the shape of a Buddhic permanent atom? We're given a shape for it. So it's not an amorphous chaos. There's still location and shape. It's said to be shaped like a figure 8. Interesting. Like a figure 8. That fits so well with Mercury and with the shape of the Antikorana and the various energy flows and with the Christ consciousness idea, the number eight. So yes, the astral permanent atom is said to be heart-shaped with a slight depression. And I've wondered whether the other permanent atoms on the triadal levels don't have, let's say, a triangular shape, let's say atmic, or perhaps a star shape of some kind related to the monastic permanent atom. In other words, God does geometrize. And if you've read the, or gotten into some of the Leadbeater and Besant work on occult chemistry, the deeper they go into the elements and molecules, the more they find that geometry is prevailing. So when we say that these are formless planes, the cosmic ethers are formless planes, we can only speak in terms of the idea that density, as we perceive it, is not existing there, but that shape and relation and design does exist, even on the level of Shambhala, on the very first or Lagoic plane. These energy flows have great patterns. In other words, on the cosmic ethers, patterns do exist. So when we talk about formless, we should not think chaotic, or we should not think amorphous. We have to still think that pattern prevails. And who knows how far pattern prevails. I would suspect that it prevails for a long way into the plains. Anyway, riseth the cave of beauty rare, of color iridescent. Now, why do we use a word like riseth? Riseth. In other words, does that suggest growth, perhaps? Something that is taking form or taking shape? Riseth. suggests taking, risheth. Okay, suggests taking form and growing. In other words, it's a process. We begin with the egoic lotus as what's called, what is the incipient beginning egoic lotus called when it's first created? There's a name for it. A lotus in bud, bud lotus, colorless, folded over, not unfolded, everything brought together in a kind of initial position, like a flower that's folded in the bud, but not unfolded. So it riseth gradually into a thing of great beauty. Now, the word cave is important. When you think of the word cave, what thoughts come to your mind? Cave. The cave within the head, okay. The general meaning of the word cave, is cave a positive space, a negative space, or both? Yes, ultimately one breaks out of the cave. Yes, yes. Safety and protection, and for a consecrated purpose. It's a protected space. It's also a limiting space. We, cave and cavern are the same, basically, aren't they? And we discovered when we were doing stanza six that we are in a darkened cavern. We are in a darkened chamber. You cannot escape the idea of limitation when you deal with the term cave. At the same time, the cave exists for special purposes, and things can be accomplished within a cave in that protected condition, which cannot be accomplished elsewhere. So obviously, the thought of the cave of initiation also comes to our mind, doesn't it? And in the cave of initiation, special processes occur which need to be sealed off from all possibility of interruption. Even a lodge is a cave. You know, and a matter of fact, I suppose in the old days, some of the rituals of early man were carried on in caves. Maybe even now they are, in sort of a replay of those early experiences. The important thing with a lodge is always to make sure it's protected. So you assign kind of a guardian angel to protect the lodge, so that there is no interruption of the processes. The womb itself is a cave. In other words, it tells you about a special process which is going on, which must not be interfered with. On the other hand, if a cave can be a prison as well, can it not? Yes. For birth. Yes, exactly. Yes, well, initiation itself is a process of birth. So retiring into a cave where you can be safe and where you can concentrate all of your forces on the particular process which must be accomplished, whether it's birth, initiation. On the other hand, you know, the negatives of that is to be denied contact with the life of God outside the cave. DK talks in the Law of Repulse for the Fifth Ray about, you know, deep in a pyramid on all sides, walled around by stone, in the deep dark of that stupendous place, a mind and brain were working in a man. Outside the pyramid, the life, outside the pyramid, the world of God established itself. The sky was blue, the winds blew free, the trees and flowers opened themselves onto the wind. But in the pyramid, down in its dim laboratory, a worker stood toiling at work. So there's this special fifth-ray process. Don't interrupt me. Stay away. I'm concentrated. I don't want to break out. I want to concentrate on what I have to do. But at the same time, you shut out everything else. So, you know, it brings us to the question of whether the causal body, for all of its beauty, may be considered a limitation. And from other perspectives, we do know it is considered a limitation, don't we? At a certain point, it is a limitation. Well, this particular stanza takes care of that limitation. It's not just ordinary beauty, it's beauty rare. It's an unusual intensity of beauty. And I've copied out here a little later what DK says about the causal body and its appearance, and he sort of holds the appearance of the causal body in awe, how beautiful it is. And for us at this present time, it should be considered beautiful. We're not there yet where we are ready to dispense with the causal body. Of color iridescent. When you think of iridescence, what do you think of? Rainbow, all the colors, changing, flashing. I took from the... okay, well, I have a couple of other things to say, but here is a idea about iridescent color. It sort of reminds one of the mother of pearl on the inside of the shell, right? So, mother of pearl, nacre, also known as mother of pearl, is an organic inorganic. Interesting, it is both. As it were, living and non-living, composite material produced by some mollusks. All of us are mollusks, really. We're cancer in the shell, you know. We have this outer shell and inner process. We have a rind, we have a skin, a peel, and we have a pulp. So we're inside the outer layers. It is also what makes up pearls. It is very strong, resilient, and iridescent. And the idea of iridescence, I wonder, iridescence, goniochromism, is generally known as the property of certain surfaces which appear to change color. Iridescence, they appear to change color as the angle of view or the angle of illumination changes. Iridescence is commonly seen in soap bubbles, butterfly wings, and sea shells. Crystals too? Yes, crystals too. And so we will see that crystal imagery emerging in this light reflectors and you know, it's prismatic because all the different colors appear. Well, how many different colors are there in the causal body? All of them? It's kind of interesting when you look at the egoic lotus anyway, that we don't get a picture of all the colors, but we get many. We are told, yeah, there's something we can look at. Actually, I think I have a better one that I have a better one here that Tuya prepared with the, where the colors are more, as DK tells us they are. Let's see. Okay. Diagrams 2. Okay, we'll look at that. And we'll look at this one. And try that. And here we are. If my computer will just, yeah, function a little more rapidly. Okay. And we'll come down. So you notice that although he says all the colors of the rays are present in the egoic lotus, that we never see the color red per se. We never see it. Now, maybe it's there, and because he says that according to the ray, the color is found. We see the color rose. It's not given. It's given to the sixth ray. We see sometimes blue is given to the first ray, a type of blue. We certainly see the indigo and two types of blue. So the second ray and sixth ray are there. We see the green. We see the yellow. Green of the third ray, yellow of the fourth ray. We see the orange of the fifth ray, which is the characteristic color of the egoic lotus. We see blue and rose for the sixth ray and violet for the seventh. We see no red. And although it might exist in the case of some first ray souls, he seems to hint at it, but he doesn't say so. It may be because we have rejected the color red in this solar system, or at least we have rejected a very influential role for it to play. Of course, the color red is also an exoteric color for the sixth ray, although an esoteric color for the first. Yes, Tuya?
Yes, I was just thinking about the blue, what we see here. Sometimes he hints about the logoic plane. That
yes.
Is,
she's saying.
So we could think about, because we have rose and could think about the sixth ray, but then the blue itself,
yeah.
Does it hint about the red?
Yeah, what she's saying basically, see they can't hear you, so I have to kind of repeat here, is that the first ray, the blue, can be suggested as a first ray color as it is in Letters on Occult Meditation, at least maybe a type of modification in our solar system. And the rose can be suggested for the sixth. But anyway, he does tell us that the first ray is rejected in our solar system, at least for the time being, because the solar locus is concentrating on developing the love wisdom aspect. So this is a kind of picture of the egoic lotus, but naturally DK tells us we can only approximate its tremendous iridescence and beauty. Yes. Okay. The abstract mind is not part of the egoic lotus per se. So the abstract mind, let's see if I have this, is found in relation to the monastic permanent atom and is a vehicle which eventually will be fully developed after the egoic lotus is dissipated. And the son of mind has to do with the mental focus on the second subplane of the higher mental plane. In a way, these are all planes of abstraction relative to the concrete mind. But sometimes the second and third levels are called higher mind, and they are equivalent to what I think is son of mind. It's kind of a unitive state of perception. But the true abstract mind is triadal in nature and relates to the monastic permanent atom and is in process of being developed through the work of the Antikorana. So even if you unfold your egoic lotus, you have not necessarily developed your abstract mind. And there are some people who have developed the abstract mind along the Antikorana who have not really fully unfolded their egoic lotus at all. There was a person with a third-ray personality in the Tibetans group, and this person had no soft line rays in the personality nature at all. That's very rare. And this person was a second-ray soul but couldn't get that second-ray energy through. And she had developed a pretty strong abstract mind, but the egoic lotus itself needed more development. So I look at the abstract mind as triadal in nature. And the true abstract mind is not in the possession of so many people, even though they can look at things in terms of the world of meaning through the higher mind. Meaning if they have some soul contact, they can look through the higher mind of the second and third subplanes. But the abstract mind is still another step. Yes. Iris, iridescent? Yes, it probably is. The idea of iridescence it suggests the idea of the iris. Yes, it does. Well, we're going to come back to this picture a lot. So I'm going to leave it here, you know. Obviously, you know, there's a huge study involved in this, and we have done some of this study a few years ago. But I do think that we're dealing with the powers of the eye, of the iris. The eye is also a kind of cave, yes. Yes, that's true, yes. Okay, planetary mind, abstract mind, the ability to think within the mind of the planetary logos. Higher mind, the ability to see the meaning of things and their interconnection. Entering the world of meaning. But to enter the world of meaning does not necessarily mean you've fully developed the abstract mind and can see the patterns within the patterns within the patterns, more in a planetary sense. That's how I understand it. There's nothing personal about the abstract mind. Within the sun of mind or meaning, there still is the transpersonal element. There's still the individual element. We could try to discriminate those things, but it doesn't reach as far in impersonal appreciation of great patterns as does the abstract mind. These terms are sometimes used a little loosely because we say that when we enter the higher mind, we're in the state of abstraction. But the sun of mind is a different quality, and the sun of mind is what I call unitive mind. It's the ability to perceive things within the unity and all interconnected and devoid of separateness. The abstract mind is the ability to see the great patterns of thought and arrangement which are working out because of divine ideas. And it doesn't have as much of that second ray quality in it as does the sun of mind. The sun of mind is located on the second subplane and carries a very strong soul unitive vibration. The abstract mind, many philosophers on the third ray have entered the abstract mind, and so have the mathematicians, but they leave out that heart and unitive quality in their thinking. So thinking in the heart is a particular quality of the sun of mind, which is found on the second subplane particularly. The whole egoic lotus thinking, if the causal body egoic lotus influences your thinking, you're able to think within the heart. And sometimes DK has said, interestingly, that the true heart is the soul. In other words, he says, if you're supposed to, and use the eye that looks out from between the two, rule number 12. Let the disciple learn the use of the hand in service. Let him seek the mark of the messenger in his feet, and let him learn to see with the eye which looks out from between the two. He says that's the soul, not the ajna center or the third eye. So it is a kind of unitive soul vision in which subject and object begin to be united, and it is the beginning of entrance into the contemplative mind and has a lot of second ray about it, seeing all things in connection. But in terms of the great patterns that God has conceived in terms of his creation, that is more the process of the abstract mind. In other words, I think Einstein was working in the abstract mind as it was fed by the intuition. I don't think he was working particularly in the sun of mind, although he did have that as well, being a Pisces and having a lot of secondary. He had that as well, but his great theories were worked out in the abstract mind, fed by the Piscean intuition. So you get some really brilliant people, mathematicians, who can work in the abstract mind, but they don't cultivate the heart quality. There is an insufficient balance. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Einstein, she says, came closer to the Son of Man. Well, he had, you know, he had a lot of the unitive ability because of the strong Cancer, Neptune, and Pisces quality. And when he, you know, he was said, he was using his imagination all the time. He says, well, when you look down at the earth, you don't see any lines that demark one country from another. So right away, that is the unitive thinking. And he was very non-separative in certain ways. So he had some of that. But what he's best known for, see, those are his moral statements. But he's best known for being able to just abstract away from everything personal and individual. Like he says, I'm not so good with people, he said, you know, even though he was reputed to have, you know, taught kids their math lessons. He says, I'm not so good with people, meaning he was abstracting away from this every personal perspective. He had not much good to say about common sense and all that. He says, you know, the accumulation of personal prejudices up to the year 17, something of that nature. I'm misquoting it. But he wanted this overarching view of things. And that's what the abstract mind, fed by his powerful third ray, I don't know what his monadic ray was, but I once thought it was the second, but now I'm inclined to think it was more the third. That abstract mind was fed by that third ray. But he had this incredible Neptunian, Cancerian, Piscean connection with the intuition. So the Neptune was very, very strong, but Saturn and Mercury were exactly conjunct in Aries. So he had this ability to concretize what he brought down. When DK defines wisdom. No, buddhi. When DK describes wisdom, it requires the buddhic content because, in fact, buddhi means wisdom, and it's related to Mercury. So it's the wisdom part related to Mercury, and it means that you're in tune with the eternal laws of creation and of the system. So it's you're attuned with eternals in wisdom, and unless the heart is activated, you don't find those. Although, you know, there's third ray wisdom and there's second ray wisdom, and actually, probably a blend of the two bring in the best of wisdom. Because I'm reminded of what it says, let the word go forth in perfect understanding. I am the worker and the work. This is from the third ray perspective on wisdom. Let the word go forth in perfect understanding. But there is a deeper form of heart wisdom which requires the buddhic plane. Okay, a little, you know, and necessary digression. The causal body is ruled by two planets, particularly Jupiter and Venus, and so the idea of beauty is found in the causal body through its association with Venus, and through Jupiter, the whole idea of its growth, its unfoldment, its expansion, the idea of of the unfoldment of consciousness. Those two planets, particularly, as a matter of fact, when in your horoscope, you have let's say a harmonious aspect or a promotive aspect between Jupiter and Venus, depending on the signs and houses, I think it's a good indication, and of course, depending upon your point in evolution, that a lot of causal growth of consciousness can be achieved. Although you usually think about Jupiter and Venus, they both have so much second ray that they should be really friends, but in the secret doctrine, they were always fighting because there's a lower side to Jupiter, which is related to the moon and to Cancer, which wants just material fulfillment. And Venus is pulling away from that, sort of as the symbol of Sanat Kumara. So there was a lot of battle going on between these two, although I don't think we have to think of it in those terms at this time. Anyway, by Jupiter and Venus, particularly in the causal body, so the beauty rare is to be expected. There is this thought that a pearl is built around a point of irritation, like sometimes a grain of sand, a tiny little nucleus that begins to build up this beautiful structure. And so the idea of pain and beauty come together again in the formation of the pearl. A pearl is always considered something of great value. You know, when you talk about a person as being a real pearl, a real jewel, you know, those things go together. So something of great value is built up through a source of pain. And yes, through the friction experienced and the attempt to solve it, this beautiful structure evolves. So it's pretty much the story of humanity, isn't it? Without pain, we wouldn't get very far. I mean, we may not like to think that way, but on our planet, the path of pain is very, very necessary to speed us on our way. I mean, what are we told about the fourth ray type? They can make very, very rapid progress or be a ne'er-do-well. That's how DK describes it. Someone who never does anything right. A ne'er-do-well. So, then just apply that to humanity too, right? Just apply that to the human kingdom. We can blunder our way through into all kinds of messes so that we're destroyed repeatedly, or we can do something very, very rapidly. And maybe both are the case, because humanity, in a way, is so far behind that it has to move rapidly at this point, wouldn't you say? In other words, we're told, you know, that we're making rapid progress now, but we're woefully behind. Well, if we could only use our imagination and we could only foresee the coming conflicts instead of just blundering into them, we could actually make a reasonable progress. But that requires intuition, connected with the fourth ray and buddhi, and the ability to imagine something in line with an archetype. And on the plane of buddhi, these archetypes are reflected. So instead of just creating all this friction, we could attune like an artist does to that particular level and maybe foresee many of the conflicts which we could avoid. The abstract mind won't give that to you because it doesn't have the heart. It doesn't have the sense of what is the true harmony between things. It's just a reflection of the buddhi. Actually, Mercury is involved in both of those cases. So I could see, Gisla, I could see an important paper coming out of the discussion of the discrimination between son of mind, i.e. general higher mind, and the qualities of the abstract mind. It's quite a discrimination, but I would just say abstract mind is a little drier. Yeah. So, well, okay. Maybe it's on the line. But excuse me. But also the entire first subplane, which is sort of the generative point for the egoic lotus, through certain of the solar angels connected with that point, that's where the abstract mind seems to be. And probably the true abstract mind would be made out of atomic matter of the mental plane. See, in a way, we don't have that vehicle completely developed yet, do we? We have the permanent atoms of the spiritual triad, don't we? We have the permanent atoms. And they were seized during the second outpouring. We discussed that yesterday morning and so forth. But we don't have the coordination of the vehicles around those permanent atoms yet, do we? So some human beings now, and especially in the sixth, the sixth sub-race of the fifth root race, will be developing the abstract mind. And people like ourselves who are trying to build the Antikarana and look at things in the larger perspective, the planetary perspective, like Dane Rudyard called it, the planetarization of consciousness. That's kind of like the abstract mind. We are entering into that. But the sixth root race will develop the intuition, which is not the same as the abstract mind. But the fact that number six as a sub-ray of the fifth root race is a six linked to the sixth root race and to the sixth principle buddhi. See, sixth principle is buddhi, and the sixth sub-race of the fifth root race develops abstract mind, so there's a definite link between the two. There's always a link between the number three and the number six. He points it out. Two ones are two, two twos are four, two threes are sixes. So there is a way to think of the number six in relation to the development of the abstract mind. And I would suggest, what sign would I suggest that should be particularly good at doing that? Using the six and the three together and developing the abstract mind. And it's also an intuitive sign. Exactly, Sagittarius. Because you know how many of these Sagittarian sort of mathematicians, abstract thinkers, and so forth, they are really good at putting buddhi and manas together. And that's what we have to do. Via the abstract mind, we have to enter the intuition. We have to almost think our way into the intuition. You might, yes, he might be a case in point, and he has a lot of the fifth ray, of course, as well. And we cannot say that the fifth ray is non-intuitive. We should not say that. I mean, all rays can be intuitive. The crystallized fifth ray type resists the intuition for a while, but someone like Bohm and other of the modern, you know, physicists who are pushing the edge, they have the intuition. That's what we're doing in classes like this. When we study cosmic fire, we tend to develop the abstract mind, but if we also are sensitive to the impression from ideas, our abstract mind will be fertilized by buddhi. And I just like to think of it this way. When I'm in the sun of mind, I'm still thinking as an individual. When I'm in the abstract mind, I'm thinking as a little part of God. I know it's like, I'm making a big cleavage about that, but that's how I like to think about it. That God's thought is coming through me when I'm in my abstract mind. My own best thought, developed over many, many years and maybe somewhat fertilized by the solar angel, are coming to me when I'm in my higher mind or my son of mind on the second subplane of the mental plane. I think it would be an interesting paper. It reflects Buddha, yes, 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 because it's the number two. And it has something to do with Neptune, and it always has the fusion factor connected with it. In other words, on the second subplane of the mental plane, what do we have? What is the city or the power that's developed there? What do we call it? Response to group vibration. Response to group vibration. It's like we can get together with others and have a group mind. So that is somewhat in response to the buddhi. But then, from another point of view, the abstract mind responds to Atma, being the first subplane of Brahma. You know, it responds to nirvanic mind. The higher mind responds, because it's on the second subplane, is more the response to buddhi. And the third subplane is the response to the higher mind. I mean, it responds to the abstract mind. Okay. These are interesting subjects, and we have to deal with them, but for the moment, we're talking about light, iridescence, changing of color from many points of view. DK tells us what a marvelous spectacle the causal body really is, and how it shimmers, and how it constantly fluctuates and changes, and how all the many colors are there with certain predominance of the main ray color. So that's what we have to think about. This shimmering, beautiful vehicle which reflects qualities which have been abstracted under the power of Venus, being upwardly drawn into the repository we call the egoic lotus. So, you know, like I said, if you can store thousands of lives of memory on the memory chip we call the permanent atom, what can you store in the causal body? In other words, every little permanent atom is a repository of all the memories that have ever occurred in the world of form during all of your thousands of lives. So what then is stored in the causal body? See, there's a tremendous memory storative factor going on in these structures. Nothing is lost. Master Moria says the hardest thing for a man to get rid of is his own tail. You know, people worry about getting rid of the past. Don't worry. The paths will follow you, you know, like your tail. So memory is there with us entirely, and there comes a time when we get to review all of the memories we've ever had. The Buddha is said to have done this in those 48 hours or so that he was under the Bodhi tree. It's beautifully described in the poem The Light of Asia by Sir Edwin Arnold. He saw everything. He even saw his incarnations as a tiger. I mean, that may be symbolic, but he and his wife were tigers together. He saw back, even into the animal kingdom, the progress of his own monad. So the memory factor is stored there in the permanent atoms. And then, when the permanent atoms are destroyed, are the memories destroyed? What do you think? But are the permanent atoms really destroyed? See, because what I think happens is the lower permanent atoms, like the mental unit, astral and physical permanent atom, are elevated, transubstantiated, lifted into the permanent atoms of the triad. It's as if those memories are abstracted into still higher permanent atoms, and ultimately they return to the monad. In other words, Master DK oftentimes tells us stories about how it used to be for him. I'm remembering my brother when I was in love, he says to someone. The greatest of all glamours, falling in love, he says. He says, I'm remembering when I once was so proud that I disappointed my master and came crashing to the earth. He doesn't have a causal body anymore. How's he remembering this stuff? See, because it's in his triadal permanent atoms. It's been abstracted upward. All of those concrete memories are still available to us. Okay, so the pearl is grown through the process of pain and irritation, and beauty is the result. There's no beauty without pain. That's what we hear in the fourth great purpose of Sanat Kumara, in Rays and the Initiations. The path of pain and the path of beauty are one. So this suggests the means by which spiritual values are harvested from the irritating or painful experiences in the lower world. All of this iridescence, you earn your iridescence. That's what I'm saying. Well, you know, what I say to Scorpio is the abstract mind, higher mind, or both. I'm just repeating it so people get it. I think that you can take any sign of the zodiac, any ray, and any planet even, and find its application to every single chakra, plane, subplane, etc. DK tells us about two aspects of Scorpio. And Mercury and the mind are involved in both of them, and one of them simply controls the emotions and the other brings about illumination. And it is my impression that Scorpio is not related to the abstract mind per se, but is related to the concrete mind, to the sun of mind, and to the intuition. And the reason I say that is because the third ray seems to be the one ray that doesn't show up in relation to Scorpio, at least when DK says that. And the third ray is the ray particularly associated with the abstract mind. So the Scorpio people I've met, of course, you know, you can't generalize too much here, but it's more the Sagittarian types. Of course, I've met some Scorpios who have Mercury and Sagittarius. They're really quite good with the abstract mind. But Scorpio per se, I think, puts you into the middle of the soul. It puts you into the concrete mind as it can control the emotions, and it definitely links with the intuition. Because that whole intuitional plane is ruled by Scorpio. And Mercury is the highest of the planets in Scorpio. And via that Mercury in Scorpio, you can destroy illusion. In other words, the intuition destroys illusion. It dispels illusion. That's where I think Scorpio comes into the picture. But in terms of theorizing and doing all that kind of expansive speculative work, I think other signs are more involved. But like I say, I can find a way, I think, to apply any energy to any level and find how it works. They're not all equal and not all balanced. But look, take a look. Our Earth is a chakra, isn't it? Okay, yeah, but I'm just saying it's a chakra. It's the root. But how many energies do we have working through our Earth? How many rays do we have working through our Earth? How many signs of the zodiac do we have working through our Earth? Would we not say all of them? And what I'm trying to say is that give me a chakra and all the energies are there, but they're not all there in the same proportion. So there's always a way to find an application of any one of the energies we work with, zodiacal, planetary, ray energies. They're all in every chakra, but not to the same extent. And overall, the chakra may be ruled by one or two of them, but they're all present. This is true of the Earth. This is true of any of our chakras. This is true of the Sun. This is true of any constellation. They're all there. But, of course, that gets confusing because there's so many. So how are you going to apply all that? That's why DK helps us narrow it down. Oh, yeah, the heart center is ruled by Jupiter or by the Sun, and yet they're all there. Inside the jewel, in the center of any chakra, all the energies are manifesting. Okay, again, we have the suggestion of Venus, the many colors, and the symbol of spiritual attainment. And we might almost think about the Philosopher's Stone here, this great structure that is grown through many lives of pain and experience, we've sometimes heard about the pearl of great price. In a way, the entire causal body is the pearl of great price and the philosopher's stone at the same time. It's a magnificent structure that has grown in pain and results in beauty and allows you to integrate and harmonize and unify your nature with that which is around you. The stronger our causal body, the more it is unfolded, the more we feel part of things and can relate in unity to the things around us. So we talked about the property of iridescence, and here is what Master DK says about the causal body. So let us look at this. Riseth the cave of beauty rare, of color iridescent, and we haven't even gotten to the second sentence yet, but that's par for the course. Okay. Just hang in there. Here's what Master DK has to say about the causal body, this marvelous structure. We have seen that on the third level of the mental plane, well, that's for most people, right? On the third level of the mental plane, the egoic lotus is found, and the student should picture itself to him, it to himself as follows. So he's giving us a picture that we, if we lack the power to see it for ourselves, should imagine in this manner. Concealed at the very center or heart of the lotus is a brilliant point of electric fire of a blue-white hue, the jewel in the lotus, surrounded and completely hidden by three closely folded petals. Well, look, if your egoic lotus is on the third subplane of the mental plane, then what DK says here is absolutely true, because the synthesis petals have not unfolded yet, revealing the jewel in the lotus. So they are, as it were, folded over the jewel in the lotus. But he's telling us that there is a central fire. Now, the minute he says the word blue-white, what comes to our mind when we think about blue-white? Yes, and yes, to a degree. To me, we're sometimes told about the blue-white diamond. Sirius is called blue star, and it also is a very pure white containing all of the spectrum of colors. So I immediately think of the Syrian connection, which of course ultimately is the cosmic Christ in a way for us, and is a major second ray star in its higher aspects. Probably Sirius, my guess is that Sirius as a star has a fifth ray soul and ultimately a second ray monad. I'm not sure about the personality nature, you know, who could judge. But anyway, blue-white oftentimes brings in the power of the first ray in the second ray solar system. So if you think about Shambhala as a diamond, to consider it as sort of a blue-white radiance, I think, is very, very effective. And in earlier we were talking about it, and Tuya had reminded us that sometimes the color blue is used in relation to the first ray, electric blue. So there's kind of a white and electric blue idea that's coming in here related to the first ray expression in a second ray solar system. Because think about where that diamond is. It's in the center of a second ray structure that we call the egoic lotus, right? The diamond is right there in the center, the jewel. But it's a second ray structure which represents the first ray of the monadic nature. So it's a two for one, if you will. It's both blue and white. Okay, it's a second ray and first ray. And three closely folded petals. Around this central nucleus or inner flame, that's a great way of looking at it, because flame is going to be very important in this particular discussion, are arranged the nine petals in circles of three petals each, making three circles in all. Sometimes he calls them circles, sometimes he calls them tiers. Or, you know, when you're talking about tiers, one is elevated above another. So there's the idea of elevation. We tend to see this lotus maybe somewhat flat in our imagination, but the idea that they can be lifted one above another should be kept into our imagination. These petals are formed out of the substance of the solar angels. Their substance energy underlies the matter of the higher mental plane and geometrizes this matter of the higher mental plane into the petal formation. So it's not like suddenly the atoms of the higher mental plane disappear. No, they are part of the lotus, but they are substanded by the energy of the solar angels. Well, there's so many mysteries here, but anyway, you know, just to kind of go on and get the idea, these petals are formed out of the substance of the solar angels, as are the central three, which have been particularly built by a stream of Buddhic energy. Substance which is not only sentient, meaning it has consciousness, as is the substance of the forms in the three worlds and the lunar bodies, but which has the quality of I-ness or of self-consciousness, enabling the spiritual unity at the center, and that's us, by means of it, to acquire knowledge, awareness, and self-realization. In other words, if you are going to put your consciousness in the egoic lotus, where are you? You know, like in the galaxy, you are here. You're right in the very center of the egoic lotus. That's where you, as a unit of life, take up your position, because you are the monad. And that's where the monad has projected itself down through the planes. Of course, the monad can split itself into many different streams. You know, you could say that, well, where is God? Well, God is everywhere. God is in all these different streams. The monad is in all these different streams. So, but you are sitting on the throne at the center of the egoic lotus, because that's where you, as the monad, are holding court, as it were. This is your kingdom, and you are an extension of the monad. You are the jiva. The jiva went forth from the monad and is making this pilgrimage, while the monad itself stays at home. And this is what Master Maurya calls the divisibility of the spirit. In other words, how the one can become the many. The monad is always an example of how the one becomes the many. So seated at the throne, in the inner fire, in the jewel, is the real you, the divine observer. And this is your kingdom. Now, what is your personal consciousness then? We say it is soul consciousness, but soul consciousness is really monadic consciousness. All awareness is of the monad. It's just contained in various ways, so that sometimes it's fuller and more extensive, and sometimes it's more confined. In other words, soul consciousness is monadic consciousness confined by the substance of the egoic lotus. Personal consciousness is monadic consciousness confined by the elemental lives. It's all monadic consciousness. There's only one perceiver, and that's the monad. Okay, these petals are formed out of the substance solar angels. They have the quality of I-ness or self-consciousness, meaning they reflect back. It's a consciousness which does not only go outward towards the object of perception, but reflects backward towards the center of perception, making the center of perception an object. So you become self-aware. The animal has the center of perception, but there's no consciousness reflecting back towards that center of perception. It's not reflexive consciousness. But Venus, when you hold up a mirror, you see who's looking in the mirror. And that's what reflexive consciousness is, and that's what the substance of these petals allows our consciousness to do, to become aware of the center. These nine petals are of a predominant orange hue. It's the major orange is the color of flame is the major color of the mental plane. Blue is involved because blue is the complement of orange, and we will see how that works a little later. They are of predominant orange hue, though the other six colors are found as secondary colors in varying degree. But let us remember that rose is there and not red, at least in the normal depictions of the egoic lotus. The nine inner petals are of a lovely lemon yellow hue, which is one of those colors which is very much connected with buddhi. I'm not sure if it's in this place, but somewhere he says a buddhic stream of energy from the buddhic plane creates the nine petals, the three petals. Now, yesterday we discussed the idea that it is the solar angel's home, truer home on the buddhic plane than on the higher mental plane. So the solar angels can be associated then with this Buddhic stream which creates the inner three petals. And I was just reading in Letters on Occult Meditation, I ran into it. He says, the true orange is much more like yellow than it is like what we consider to be orange. So here we're talking about the solar angels in relation to the color yellow, which is a truer orange. At the base of the lotus petals are the three points of light which mark the position of the permanent atoms. It's an unusual way of saying it, isn't it? But it's at the base of the lotus, and which are the medium of communication between the solar angels, because there are a number of solar angels involved with any particular human being. It's an emanative thing. One major solar angel, I think, and many different emanations into the different tiers and petals. At the base of the lotus petals are the three points of light which mark the position of the permanent atoms and which are the medium of communication between the solar angels and the lunar petries. We sometimes think, oh, a personality, I've got several lunar petries, right? But I've only got one solar angel. But when we read more deeply into the discussion of the egoic lotus, we find out that the egoic lotus is also a group entity with a number of solar angels of different categories. Sometimes he calls solar lords and solar petries and things of that nature. He hasn't specified exactly what they are, but there are a variety of solar angels involved in the egoic lotus structure. Okay, by means of these permanent atoms, the ego, and notice here, I think it's Lona, this is capitalized. But in this particular case, I don't think it means the monad. So sometimes he takes the word ego with a capitalization, and it still means soul or solar angel. By means of these permanent atoms, the ego, according to its state of evolution, can construct his lunar bodies. So this is the solar angel soul. Acquire knowledge on the lower three planes, who wants it, and thus by his experience. There's money involved here. It's Venus, okay? You have to pay for your experience and become aware. So through the permanent atoms, the ego is functioning in the lower worlds. On a higher turn of the spiral, the monad through the egoic petals, and thus with the aid of the solar angels who are underlying the egoic petals, see, solar angels and petals, acquires knowledge and equally on more exalted levels becomes aware. So it's like these centers of consciousness. What did we call the monad yesterday? The divine center of consciousness. That was the name that was used for it, correct? Page 168 in Esoteric Psychology 1. It's a good way of thinking about the monad. The divine center of consciousness seeks consciousness in the lower worlds, having mastered great consciousness in the higher worlds. The light within these permanent atoms has a dull red glow. That's initially when it's on the third subplane in the beginning of evolution. And we have, therefore, all the three fires demonstrating in the causal body. Electric fire at the center, the inner flame, the jewel, and the lotus, representing the first ray. Solar fire enclosing it as the flame encloses the central nucleus or essence in a candle flame. Now, that means that the three inner or synthesis petals have much of the second ray or solar fire connected with them, because Buddhi and solar fire go together, and also the nine. You know, it's a bit like this. The spiritual triad is analogous to the three petals that enclose the jewel. Can we make an analogy like that, do you think? The spiritual triad, think of it. Around the monad stands the triad, correct? Around the representation of the monad in the egoic lotus, which is called the jewel in the lotus, stand the three petals. I've sometimes wondered, what are the rays of the triad? Is it a first ray structure or is it a second ray structure? What do you think? The spiritual triad. Or is it both? See what I mean? The spiritual triad is like the personality of the monad. It represents a first ray center. But the true soul is the spiritual triad, and the ray of the triad is reflected in the ray of the soul. So the spiritual triad is like a transitional level or organ, and it has both first ray and second ray in it. What about these synthesis petals? Are they exclusively second ray? Are they exclusively first ray? Or are they transitional? between the second and first ray. What do you think? I think they're transitional, because they are definitely related to the ray of the soul. Whatever the triadal ray is, that's the ray of the soul. That's, again, on page 168 and 169, Esoteric Psychology, Volume 1. It tells us that amazing thing. According to the ray of the monastic permanent atom, so is the ray of the soul. And all triadal atoms have the same ray.
So when it comes to the spiritual triad, would you say that that is the so-called divine soul and the egoic soul is just the personal soul?
Okay, well, you're saying is the spiritual triad the divine soul? People have different names for this. And is the egoic lotus the personal soul? I like to call the egoic lotus the transpersonal, but I keep the word personal in it. Suprapersonal center, but still personal. And you could say, you know what I would say for the spiritual triad? I would call it spiritual soul. I would call the soul of the monad, or the consciousness of the monad, divine soul. In other words, the awareness of the monad I would call divine soul. That type of consciousness which is found in the spiritual triad I would call spiritual soul. And then I would call transpersonal soul or suprapersonal soul that which is found on the higher mental plane in the causal body. I would differentiate in that way. It's fine, but for me, even though he calls it both divine and spiritual, if I wanted to make really keen discrimination, I would say spiritual belongs to the triad, divine belongs to the monad. And he actually does say that, you know, the divine center of consciousness. The word divine is always connected with, or frequently connected with the monad itself. So, but look, you know, we can in the mind, we can make discriminations like this. You know, this is different from this, different from this. But can we experience the difference? That's the question. That squirrel is on its way. It's on the second ray. Don't worry. he gathers the knowledge of the nuggets of the world as the squirrel stores its nuts. He stores the nuggets of the knowledge of the world. That's right. Okay, that's the second ray scholar. The squirrel will become a second ray scholar. See, just store enough nuggets and you're there. Okay. Okay. Onward. Here we go. So look inside. Look, we got to get through this description at least. All right. We have demonstrating inside the causal body all three fires. The center point, the inner fire, is the jewel of the lotus, ray one. The solar fire is sort of, solar fire and electric fire are kind of in combination when we talk about the synthesis petals. What is the urge to synthesis? What ray does it usually come in on? Synthesis. There's different kinds of synthesis, but usually he gives us the seven methods of inducing soul control. And the urge to synthesis, or the factor of synthesis, is on ray one. But it is the second aspect of ray one, because ray two is synthetic as well. So when you put these, the idea of ray one and two together, you get the original synthesis. There's also ray four for synthesis, ray seven, different kinds of synthesis. So solar fire enclosing it as the flame encloses the central nucleus, and fire by friction. This latter resembling the glowing red wick, which lies at the base of the higher flame. There's an analogy for us. The glowing red wick is connected with fire by friction. And of course, the fire, the color red, is a Martian color. Mars is the major planet of friction, and it's a non-sacred planet. So we get the picture, I think. These three types of fire on the mental plane, you know, three minds unite eventually, meeting and unified in the egoic body, this time, of course, the adjective has a small e connected with it, produce in time a radiation or warmth which streams out from all sides of the lotus and forms that spheroidal shape noted by investigators. So this roundness, this circular nature, it's associated with the warmth of solar fire. Although all fires seem to be involved here. The more fully developed the ego may be, and, you know, it's not the monad in this case, it's a capital E, ego. The more fully developed the ego may be, and the more the petals are unfolded, the greater the beauty of the surrounding sphere. So there's the maybe very tiny egoic lotus, but a huge surrounding sphere getting bigger and bigger and bigger all the time, depending on the development of the individual, and the more refined its coloring. Remember, now some of you have studied formula number 4 in Discipleship in the New Age, Volume 2, right? So it's all about, it's called the sun on the square. And it's all about this picture of the sun within the square and how the colors of this sun, which are all of them, gradually turn from gaudy and opaque clashing and garish into a refined and beautiful representation of color. So that's basically what is happening for all of us. If you look at the egoic lotus of a primitive human being, whatever petals there are, the colors are not going to be refined, and later they are. What is refinement anyway? And what planet does it come under, do you think? Venus. I would say Venus. We have three factors coming out of Shambhala: purification, destruction, and organization. Can we relate refinement to purification? I think so. So the more refinement, the degree of refinement is the degree to which any structure or form approximates its archetype. Does that make sense? The closer to the archetype, the more refined is the structure or the form. Does that make sense? Yeah, okay. All right. At the early stages, after individualization, the egoic body has the appearance of a bud. We've all seen the flowers in bud, right? The electric fire at the center is not apparent. It's completely covered. And all the 9 petals, he's not even talking about the inner 3, are closed down upon these inner 3. The orange color has a dead aspect. It's not radiant, it's not luminous. And the 3 points of light at the base are just points and nothing more. The triangle, which is later seen connecting the points, is not demonstrating. There's no relationship between the mental unit, the astral and physical permanent atoms. The surrounding sphere, and there is a sphere, is colorless and is only to be appreciated as undulatory vibrations like waves in the air or ether reaching barely beyond the petal outline. So it's quite small, a sphere. Now still, we have not established how big an egoic lotus really is in terms of inner measurement. Because I think, you know, spatial measurement exists on the inner planes, because he tells us that some causal bodies are ovoid and some are circular, and they have a specific gravity. They have a weight, actually. So all of these kinds of measurements that remind us of measurements on the physical plane, they also exist even on the higher mental plane, which is a world of form. So we should not get rid of the idea of physicality when we speak of the egoic lotus. It is a physical structure because it is in the dense physical body of the solar logos. Now maybe that comes as kind of a, you know, because it's said to be a rupa. When you get onto the higher mental plane, it's said to be the a rupa plane, which means non-form, but there's definitely form and all of the physical measures. Although how to measure them, that will come later. By the time the third initiation is reached, a wondrous transformation has transpired. The outer sphere is palpitating with every color in the rainbow. Does that include red? Okay. It's palpitating with every color in the rainbow and is of wide radius. The streams of electrical energy circulating in it are so powerful that they are escaping beyond the periphery of the circle, resembling the rays of the sun. So he's painting a picture for us, and he tells us that we should picture the egoic lotus in this way. So resembling the rays of the sun, the nine petals, third initiation, are fully unfolded, forming a gracious setting for the central jewel. And their orange hue is now, it's not dead anymore, it's now of a gorgeous translucence. Light is pouring through it. You can see the light, shot with many colors, that of the egoic ray predominating. And this is what makes me think that even the color red will be somehow visible within the egoic lotus, because red is said to be the esoteric color of the first ray. Esoteric. Well, because orange is yellow. Well, it's getting closer to Buddhic. Well, you know, orange is also said to be an exoteric color of the first ray. But all I'm saying is that somehow in all of the depictions we have been given, the color red is never mentioned in the lotus itself. But here we are told every color of the rainbow. Well, when you look at a rainbow, you have red. It's there. And there is this orange translucence, and the orange is more like yellow because it's approximating more of a golden nature. It's more sun-like. And the egoic color predominates. The esoteric color of the first ray is red. Look at China and their love of red. Red and black, you know? How often the red dragons are found. Red China, red. And it's not just the sixth ray, it's their first ray soul. Even though perhaps from the fact that Taurus rules China, some of the orange would come in there in relation to Vulcan. But when you look at Vulcan, you might get more the red, you might get the red-orange feeling from Vulcan. Not entirely red, not entirely orange, but sort of volcanic. It's a combination of the two. But anyway, China has a love affair with red. And I think we will see more of that. It's not necessarily the red of blood, you know, which is related to the sixth ray and to Mars. Okay. When you wear red, you're making a statement, aren't you? What are you saying? Is anybody here wearing red? I can't see. Yes. Yes, go ahead, Tuya. Yes.
The go ahead. Highest logoic plane, it is ruled by Leo and the sun. So the sun has both blue and it has also the red.
The sun has blue and red, and the highest logoic plane is ruled by the sun. Yes.
Yeah, Leo.
Okay. Well, we're into this whole question of color. We can't go into it too deeply. We ought to have a class with a special study of color sometime. Would be really, you know, that would be really important to do at some time. We're sometimes talking about whether there will be any classes continuing here along these lines, and that would be, I think, a very good one, to look into DK's color symbolism and try to fathom how to use color, not only theoretically, but practically. Okay, so in Esoteric Psychology 1, when he deals with the first ray, he has different kinds of colors, but he lists particularly red and orange, the roaring orange light, which is more, you know, it's almost like orange is a color on which the fifth ray can be transmuted into the first ray, because the fifth ray souls do become first ray souls. So orange is related to both, but the fifth ray is not related to the color red, although the first ray orange will give kind of a bridge for fifth ray orange to reach it. Well, you know, I'm going to try to resist the temptation to get too much into color here. I just want to read this description of how Master DK says we are to picture the egoic lotus, okay? Apparently, picturing it is important. Imagining what it's like is important. The triangle at the base, this is after the third initiation, is now quickened and scintillating, and the three points are small blazing fires shown to the eye of the clairvoyant as sevenfold whirls of light circulating their light from point to point of a rapidly moving triangle. Now, no problem with the permanent atom of the physical and astral plane. What is the structure of the mental unit? Is it sevenfold? Is the mental unit sevenfold? Because he says sevenfold whorls of light. So, you know, it's not. The mental unit is not sevenfold. It is basically fourfold. But if you add the threefoldness of the monastic permanent atom to the fourfoldness of the mental unit, you do get a sevenfold nature on the mental plane, don't you? 3 plus 4 is 7 is the triangle above the square. So I'm not sure why DK says this. Sometimes there are lesser worlds which could possibly make up the seven. Anyway, by the time the fourth initiation is reached, the activity of this triangle is so great that it looks more like a wheel in rapid evolution. It says that the form shatters the connection. So these are the symbols of form, and it's going to shatter the connection of the monad with the outer form, with the personality. By the time the fifth initiation is reached, the activity of the triangle is so great that it looks more like a wheel in rapid revolution. It has a fourth dimensional aspect. The three petals at the center are opening up. Well, I would say they had better open up completely by the time the fourth initiation is taken. But on the approach, they open up, revealing the blazing jewel, not just the inner fire, but the blazing jewel. At this initiation, and we're going to read about it in the stanza, through the action of the Hierophant, Sanakumara, wielding the electric rod of power, the flaming diamond, the three fires are suddenly stimulated by the downflow of electric or positive force from the monad. This is very important because when we go further into this stanza, we're going to read about the interior fire and the exterior fire. Now, the fire within and the fire without. So we're bringing down, Sanat Kumara stimulates it, a tremendous flow of positive force from the monad. And their blazing out in response produces that merging which destroys the entire sphere, dissipates all appearance of form, and produces a moment of equilibrium or of suspension in which the elements are consumed with fervent heat. This is the fourth initiation process, and what we are reading about in this stanza is that, isn't it? Okay. The moment of highest radiation is known, I suppose, just at the fourth initiation. Then through the pronouncement of a certain word of power, we're not going to be told what it is, the great solar angels gather back into themselves the solar fire. Thus, in other words, they take away the structure of the egoic lotus, thus producing the final dissipation of the form, and hence the separation of the life from form. And that's rule 10, or rather law number 10 in healing. The very end of it is all about the destruction or death of the causal body. The fire of matter returns to the general reservoir, and the permanent atoms and the causal body are no more. The central electric fire becomes, aha, now look at this. The central electric fire and does not go straight to the monad yet. The central electric fire that's in the center of the jewel and the lotus is centralized in Atma Buddhi. So this is a very, very important point. As a matter of fact, it's so important. What page are we on? Does anybody know? Well, that's nice to know. Okay, thank you. The central fire becomes 764 TCF. I've got to write this down. Sorry. 764, because the jewel in the lotus does not go straight to the monad yet. Not yet. First in Atma Buddhi, whatever that really means. So, no, this is cosmic fire. This is cosmic fire. This part is cosmic fire, yeah. Okay, so I just, AAB extract, the central fire. Okay, central fire, central electric fire, monadic fire, jewel, in lotus, becomes centralized in Atma Atma and Buddhi, Atma, Buddhi, at the fourth initiation. Okay, this is very important because you sometimes wonder, when the egoic lotus falls apart, where does everything go? And he's just told us something very important, that the jewel in the lotus, which is the central fire, does not go straight to the monad, but stops first at Atma Buddhi. Sometimes the monad is called Atma Buddhi, but I think that we're being given important knowledge about the process. Okay, now let's just go on and read a little bit more. Hang in there. I'm going to try to, unfortunately, my computer is not going as fast as I am. So there's half of my head. Okay. Here we go. Sense of Zen, interpretive suggestions. Okay, good. The thinker or spiritual entity stands free of the three worlds. Who is the thinker? Who is the spiritual entity? And functions consciously on the Buddhic plane. So you are still the thinker and spiritual entity when you function and focus at the fourth initiation on the Buddhic plane. You don't require your lower mind in order to do that. Between these two stages of quiescent, though self-conscious inertia, and that of radiant activity, which produces a balancing of forces, there's Libra, is a long series of lives. How many? Thousands. Of course, we don't know the inner egoic cycles, you know, so you can't say, live 100, die 100. You know, you can't do that. But what you can't, because there's many times when we're not in incarnation at all for long periods of time, depending on our egoic ray. But many, many lives between these early days of sort of dull activity when things are not very connected and this climax of incredible radiance. So this is how Master DK wants us to picture the causal body. Do we get some kind of vivid images out of this? I think so, don't we? When you think of how do I look today? Well, you just think about this. See? When you look at yourself in the mirror, just say, that's an illusion. Right? Who's the real you anyway? Do you, you know, do you comb your hair or do you fluff your petals? What do you do? Okay, it's just a question of trying to consider and look at what we really are, what's our really real inner structure. But then, you can never see yourself anyway, because the true you is the unseen seer, right? Can you actually see what you are ever? You can only be what you are, I think. But that's another question. All right, so here, although long, was this picture of how Master DK wants us to visualize the egoic lotus. This whole thing is about the egoic lotus, and he has other words to say about it. He calls it the cavern of iridescent beauty. He's going to call it the crystal sphere. He's going to call it all different kinds of names. But we should refer them back to this more literal description of the egoic lotus. Okay. So I think we will be able to see similarities here between stanza 7 and his description. Shineth the walls with azure tint. Why azure? And what is azure? Azure. The walls of what? The walls of the cave, right? They have an azure tint. Or do they have an orange tint? Or are orange and azure related? What is the complementary color of orange? It's a blue of a kind, right? Is it an azure blue? I'm not sure. The complementary color of violet is what color? Yellow. Okay, so the lighter the blue, complementary color of red is green. Okay, so we have those. So what is the complement of indigo? Is it's kind of an orangey, yellowy kind of thing? I'm trying to think, the darker the color, in other words, if the blue is light, a lighter color or medium color, what color is the orange? If the blue is very, very dark, what color is the complement? Lighter. Mm-hmm. So, in other words, the way he described orange as being more like yellow might fit with the indigo. Is that possible? Okay. shineth the walls with azure tint. Well, one of the major colors of the second ray is blue, and when I looked up azure, it's related to lapis lazuli. And lapis lazuli has that very deep blue, beautiful tint to it. It's more like the indigo, but it has a little bit of an electric quality. I was in Germany long ago, and at one of the castles that King Ludwig II of Bavaria built, and we went into a certain room, and there were, I don't know how many pillars, 12, maybe, I don't know, I can't remember the count, large pillars of solid lapis lazuli. The country went bankrupt, but he enjoyed himself. He had an eye for beauty. What has changed? I think Ludwig was a fourth ray soul, is my impression when I look at him. He had an incredible fourth ray, you know, with a sixth ray personality. He was a great devotee of Wagner and made the staging of a presentation of Wagner's operas, a number of them, possible. But anyway, he had this taste for magnificence and grandeur. He was a Virgo. Anyway, he built these great interior spaces and exterior Walt Disney-like castles. Perfect place for many Disney films would be King Ludwig's castles. And when I saw those pillars of solid lapis lazuli, I said, this is extravagant, perhaps? You know, it's a very precious type of stone. Anyway, azure and lapis are related. And since the egoic lotus represents the second aspect of divinity, we would expect to see this color present in the structure of the causal body in a general way. So there's a general blue, there's a general orange, and they are complements. And later he's going to tell us a rose is involved as well, and we can decide why we think so. All right, now I know it's just about time. We have 2 minutes before we have to take our break. You know how it goes. Loud microphone level. Yes, okay. A little bit less, maybe a little less. Let me know if I become inaudible. Okay. Now, going on, just a little bit. And we talk about complementary colors. Here it is. What do you think about this? Shineth the walls with azure tint, bathed in the light of rose. The walls of the cavern, the walls of the iridescent cave are shining with an azure tint. Now, what is a wall anyway? Yeah, it's a shell. And all temples, you know, sort of under Cancer, they have their separating barrier to keep the energies without from coming within. So, you know, this is this may be a literal description, but at the same time, it is symbolic. So blue is connected with the second ray. Orange is the complement of blue. The esoteric color of the fifth ray is indigo. So we have this connection between the two. Now, what about the color rose? What about why do we have here the idea? Yes. Bathed in the light of rose. The walls are of azure tint. Say it again, Mimi. Yes, yes. It is to do with love. The rose is to do with love. Yes. Whatever shade rose suggests to you, it's not red. When you add white to red, you get, you know, progressively pink and rose and so forth. But why should the causal body... First of all, what ray does rose signify? Sixth ray. Okay. And blue signifies the second ray. And some shades of blue signify the sixth ray as well. And we find Master KH, a great second ray master, working with devas of what colors? That's Jesus, believe it or not. Master Jesus works with violet. Must have a lot to do with manifesting the church, you know. But interestingly, Master KH is working with the very two colors which are here described, the blue and the rose. And it's what it suggests to me is that when the astral body is influenced very much by the factor of love, after the second initiation, the rose color really applies. Now, I'm interested also in what we all might call the transformation of the cross. There's a society, a ritualistic society, called what? Exactly. The Brothers of the Rosy Cross, the Rosicrucians. And the transformation of the cross into rose signifies what? I think, you know, it's the elevation of the power of aspiring love towards the true love. It's like rose into blue, something of that nature. There is one of these old commentaries that's fantastic along that line. See if I can find it. Yeah, Lona. Mars and higher Mars. Yes, the lower Mars is red, turns into rose. Sacrificing the blood of the heart, and then it transforms into rose. Yes, I think there's a lot to be said for what you're just saying there. Let's see if we can find rose, cross, overturned. Overturn. Well, rose, cross. How many are there? This is the old commentaries. Let's see if I can find it. Deeps and shallows, shopping stones. No. Forearms meet. Ah, here it is. Discipleship in the New Age, a section from the old commentary. You know, you're going along the tunnel, and it's dark, and the lonely, and the voices are around you. And here's what it says. The cave is long and narrow. The air is full of fog. Sounds like our life, doesn't it? The sound of running water meets the rushing sound of wind and frequent roll of thunder. Now here comes. Far off and most vaguely seen, an oval opening in its color blue. Appears an oval opening in its color blue. Stretched athwart this space of blue, a rosy cross is seen. We have the union of the blue and the rose, right? Stretched across this space of blue, a rosy cross is seen, and it's oval, meaning it's the causal body, right? Where four arms meet, a rose. Upon the upper limb, a vibrant diamond shines within a star five-pointed. Oh, that's marvelous. Okay, the living soul, that's us, drives forward towards the cross, which bars his way to life. In other words, there's this, you have to penetrate the disc of golden light, you have to go beyond the cross, you have to go beyond the fourth initiation in order to find your way into life. Not yet the cross is mounted, and therefore left behind, but onward goes the living soul, eyes fixed upon the cross, ears open to the wailing cries of all his brother souls. The cross will be overturned, we will enter into life, but the blue and the rose are together in this stage just before entering truly into life. So somehow in this egoic lotus causal body fourth initiation stage, the blue and the rose do combine. The transmutation of the cross, and I think someone said it, through sacrificial love. From the darkened cross to the rosy cross. So in a way, matter has been transformed through love. That's one of the ways of thinking about the rosy cross. Okay, now it is time to take a break. Okay, let's see where we are here. Okay, everybody, there's about 17 of us at the moment. We have just been, for some of you who have just come, we've just read the description of the egoic lotus causal body as DK would like us to conceive it. And then we are back into our stanza, which is stanza number 7, and we are talking about the combination of the blue and the rose. And I turn to the old commentary here in Discipleship in the New Age, Volume 1. Where are we in that? Page something. Page 676. 675. And we see that combination of blue and rose together. These are the two colors of the devas that Master Kutumi works with. And he's working with the reappearance of the Christ especially. So the blue is very, very important, as is the color rose, which I think signifies redemption of matter through sacrifice. At least that's one of the definitions of the rosy cross. Someone brought up the idea of Mars, the red of Mars, and maybe the rose color of a higher Mars, when that type of energy, which is usually so aggressive, is turned towards self-sacrifice. So we're just taking a short break here, and later today I want to give everyone a chance to say a little something. I'm sorry, you know, this is not the interactive webinar, which would be ideal. That type of webinar is not ideal for when one is teaching a class in person. But when we have the webinars later without class presence, then they can be interactive. So we'll do it that way. So just hang on for a little while. Some of you are in countries where you should be asleep, okay? And we will continue with our discussion of stanza number 7, which basically is about the destruction of the causal body and the taking of the fourth initiation. So, all right.